Good evening, this is Josh Spicer from GameWisdom.com, and welcome to another episode of the Perceptive Podcast. We got a great cast for you tonight. My guest is the lead designer from That Game Company, which is famously known for the very interesting and unique title, Journey. They are currently working on an unannounced title, which unfortunately I won't be able to squeeze that information out of him. But let's introduce him to the cast. Please welcome Michael Hyland.
Hey there, Josh.
Hi, Michael. It's a pleasure to have you on tonight.
Pleasure to be here.
Yeah, and this is definitely going to be an interesting cast. That Game Company has really established themselves as a very interesting and unique developer. You guys have been with Sony since, has it been since the PS3 era?
Yeah, actually, our first kind of big game, Flow, was a PS3 launch title. I should just add a little disclaimer that I've been at... we call it TGC usually. I've been at That Game Company for 2.5 years now. So I came on after Journey, but I know a lot about the past games that we did with Sony, Flow and Flower, and then Journey.
Cool. To get things started, for people listening to the cast who may not have heard of TGC or may only know it from Journey, could you tell us a little bit about the background of what TGC is and maybe a little bit about yourself and what your role is at the company?
Yeah, sure. So TGC was started by a group of students coming out of USC's game development program. And one of their student games called Flow, which was designed by Genova Chen, our creative director, mm-hmm. And built by some of the other people who started the company, wound up getting picked up by Sony. And Sony basically offered them a 3-game contract to make basically artistically inspired, emotionally driven games. The company was founded with the idea of making games that would explore emotions and experiences not being... that couldn't really be found in the game industry. So Flow is sort of the most academic of the games, but it was based on Csikszentmihalyi's research into flow states. And the idea was to create a game that anyone, no matter what their skill level was, could sort of engage with and enter a flow state. So it used a kind of dynamic difficulty algorithm to try to make the game engaging no matter how good or poor your skills were. Mm-hmm. The second game, Flower, was inspired by Genova, our creative director's experience of sort of coming to America and seeing kind of like the rolling green hills of California, actually on a trip to the Game Developers Conference from Los Angeles to San Francisco. Mm-hmm. And that feeling of sort of being in nature and contrasting with his experiences of growing up in Shanghai sort of gave rise to this game that was about the tension between the natural world and kind of the hustle bustle of the city. And then finally, Journey was intended to be a multiplayer game that wasn't combative or competitive, but was really about experiencing being with a stranger in a world, in a space together, and forming basically an anonymous connection with them by playing this game together. In Journey, you're matched up with anonymously with other people who are playing the same part of the game. So you get this very interesting experience of wondering who that person is and projecting sort of maybe your fantasy of who that person might be onto this other avatar. I know, like, when my father played Journey, I played with him, his initial assumption was that the other person he was meeting was someone else's dad also playing the game, which very likely it's like a, you know, probably a teenage girl in Japan. But for him, what he needed at that moment and what the game allowed to happen was for him to project the type of companion that he felt most comfortable being with. So those are the last three big games. And I played Journey. And at the time I had been working on some indie games in Philly, and I had published an iOS game that was like a kind of sardonic bicycle racing game called Hipster City Cycle. And I had been aspiring to make games that I guess would positively impact people beyond just pure entertainment. And I played Journey, and I was sort of familiar with TGC's previous games, but I was so impressed with Journey, and then I found out more about the company and little by little managed to get my foot in the door and then the rest of me through the door. That was 2.5 years ago. And initially my role there was as a field engineer. TGC is sort of unique in that we don't have any dedicated designers. Everyone who sort of does design work is also a programmer or writes code. So about half the team is what we call field engineers, which are basically designer programmers who are responsible for all the gameplay systems, controls, camera, everything that the player kind of interacts with directly. And then in addition to that, we have a couple kind of lower level engineers who work on our engine. And we have some artists who are just dedicated to doing, you know, concept work and building assets. So I was doing that for a number of years. And then very recently, I kind of took on this role of lead designer, which is really just means I'm doing more organizational stuff than anything else. I'm not it's a pretty flat company. Mm-hmm. The creative control is very much shared among everyone. And it's a very collaborative and kind of organic process. So, that was a long answer.
Oh, don't worry. All the answers to that question are long answers. Now, one thing that you just brought up that I want to talk about with you, Michael, you mentioned that TGC, is a flat architecture, which is similar to companies like Valve. Mm-hmm. And I spoke with the CEO of Beta Dwarf a few months ago, who's also running a flat architecture, mm-hmm. which for those of you listening, what that means is that the studio doesn't really have like a hierarchy in the sense that, you know, there's someone who's above someone else. Usually everyone can contribute to projects. And as you said, it's pretty much, you know, everyone can do what they want. Everyone does a little bit of everything at the studio. Mm-hmm. And my question for you, Michael, is how do you find that type of game development style for yourself working there? Because it's definitely something that we hear from a lot of developers that people outside that can find that a little weird. But so far, the people who I've spoken to, such as the CEO from Beta Dwarf, he said he really enjoys it and he really loved, you know, that style from Valve.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, Valve is unique in that they're able to do it at such a big scale. Mm-hmm. It's really impressive. Right now, TGC, we're 15 people. And I don't know, the flat thing is a mixed bag. It's great creatively, but it's also comes with it kind of like a equally distributed existential weight of sort of responsibility where I think everyone, at least I'm speaking for myself, but what I understand from other people too in the company is that everyone feels very responsible for the game. Mm-hmm. And for myself, there are multiple systems that I've touched or that I'm partially responsible for, and managing that responsibility and the kind of like question of like, am I working on the right thing? What's the most important thing for me to be working on right now is like uses up a lot of mental and emotional bandwidth. Whereas in a more hierarchical company, you'd have your kind of orders and direction coming down from a higher power. Mm-hmm. And I don't know, I think I wouldn't choose that, but I can see there being greater efficiency in that. For TGC, I think we tend to take longer than expected for our games. Our process is not super efficient, but what it's good at is, I don't know, making cool stuff, making stuff that actually like is worth keeping. We don't force decisions, and we're very kind of like meditative about, you know, is this working? Is it not working? Is this giving us the feelings we want? And that's a real luxury to be able to like not have to make, you know, mm-hmm. pressure decisions, but it means that our games can take a long time, and that's challenging for our fans, and it's challenging for, you know, the team also to be in that process.
Yeah. And looking at the credits for your games, looks like you've had a game release like in every 3 years, Flow, Flower, then Journey. Uh-huh. And as you said, with that flower architecture, definitely lends itself to more unique studios. Mm-hmm. And I want to go back to what you said a few minutes ago when you were describing the inspiration behind Flow, Flower, Journey and how each game pretty much had a radically different philosophy or radically different thought process behind how it was created. And you really don't hear that type of thought behind a lot of games, especially those that are aimed like at the AAA or mass market.
Sure.
Many people approach games strictly from a mechanic or a product point of view, but you guys at TGC definitely look at things more from the art and, you know, what inspires you. And you said earlier the goal was to make very unique games, very unique forms of storytelling.
Yeah, and that's definitely true. I mean, we are not a mechanics company. Like, none of our, you know, there's things that we're reusing from Journey and from previous games in the new game. Like, there's a, we've built up an engine which has tools that we're using, but we really aren't, we're not starting a project with a sense of like, okay, these are the main mechanics of this game. How do we build a story and a world around those mechanics? We're starting with, this is the feelings and the kind of emotional takeaway we want players to have. What are the best mechanics that we can come up with to kind of trigger that or to help people get there? And then what winds up happening a lot is we prototype hundreds and hundreds of different mechanics. I mean, in a way, it feels to me now that like interesting game mechanics are kind of like a dime a dozen. It's easy to come up with them, but actually coming up with ones that work together in a harmonious way for a specific emotion is like sometimes feels like a needle in a haystack. We have lots to work with, and we what's starting to happen now with the current project is we've gotten to a point where it feels like we have enough stuff and we can start removing things and kind of do design by subtraction. And I don't know, my guess is, like, Journey was very simple in its mechanics, is that our new game will also be kind of much simpler than some of the prototyping we've done, you know, through the middle of the project.
Okay. And I definitely want to ask you about the design process a little bit more in depth with TGC. I'm going to slur that every chance I get for the next
You can say that game company, too. That's
that may help me. My tongue...
It'll be easier.
My tongue just... You don't even want to know the amount of trouble I had. For those of you who've listened to this cast for a long time, you may remember that it took me forever to be able to pronounce Bethesda. It took me like 2-3 months of just like practicing in front of a mirror to get that right. But I do really want to talk more about the design philosophy in depth in a few minutes with you, Michael. I do have a few more just general questions regarding that game company's like the organization structure before we move on. We talked about this before the cast, but I just want to clarify it for the recording, and that is that game company, right now, you guys are considered a third-party developer, is that right?
No, no, we're independent now.
Okay.
Yeah, I mean, we don't have a publishing partner, so I guess we're kind of no party for the time being. We have venture capital backing, so I guess in a way, the VCs are kind of acting as a publisher. In terms of putting up the money for the new project, but they're actually, you know, they're invested in the company as opposed to just a single project. So yeah, we were for the first three games, we were kind of like a second party developer with Sony. After Journey, we decided to do our own thing.
Okay. And your next game, the one that we unfortunately can't talk about tonight, that one will also be locked to the PlayStation 4?
No, it's actually, we don't have any platform restrictions. I mean, that was sort of the part of the impetus in breaking with Sony was so that we could bring our games to more platforms, because like Journey, for example, was either the top downloaded or the most downloaded game on the PlayStation Network. So it was very successful within that context, but in terms of like actual numbers, it's still not that much. So it was like did very well for where it was, but if we really reach a wider audience, for us it meant getting outside of the PlayStation system.
Yeah, definitely. And that's something that we hear from a lot of developers, especially those who are currently in the space, who have been trying to break out or get into Steam. to sell their games. It's becoming a lot more important to spread your game to multiple platforms and systems. I know Clay Entertainment, who I've spoken to a few times in the past, they have been, well, actually, they first started out on the consoles, then they moved to the PC with Early Access and Steam, and now they're coming back to the consoles. I know Don't Starve, I think it's going to be one of the games on the PlayStation 4, like the indie network version of that. Yep, and it's definitely getting interesting to see how these games are going to do on different platforms. Another quick example, when I spoke with Yacht Club Games, who did Shovel Knight, they talked specifically about how, even though they were inspired to make a NES-esque platformer, they knew they wanted to release it on the PC due to hoping that there was an audience for that. And with your games at that game company, especially with like Journey and, as we said, the very unique approach you guys take to it, it's going to be interesting to see how other markets, especially the PC market, is going to view these games.
Yeah, it's still a question of whether, I mean, Journey is such a unique game. There wasn't really anything else like it at the time. Well, maybe Unfinished Swan is sort of a similar artistic game. But a lot of people who play Journey were people who had a PlayStation in their house, like their kids, you know, have a PlayStation, and that's how they wind up playing Journey, or someone, you know, not the primary user of the console gets someone else to play it. And it was definitely not I think hardcore, you know, dedicated PlayStation users also enjoyed it. But we get a lot of stories of people who sort of are saying, like, this is the first video game I've played. And our hope is to reach more, you know, first-time gamers in a way. And obviously the console is not always, well, maybe especially the PlayStation tends to market more towards the sort of dedicated gamer.
Yeah, definitely with that. And that's another thing that we're seeing more is trying to branch out away from the core hardcore markets and trying to get more casual gamers. Obviously, the mobile and social game markets have been huge examples of that.
Yeah, exactly.
All right. I think with that, I think that's the last question I have regarding the studio side of that game company. I think we can start delving a little bit more into the design philosophy and how you guys go about developing your games, because I'm sure this is going to be interesting. So a few minutes ago, we obviously talked about inspirations that Dry, Flowers, Flow, and Journey. And you mentioned a few minutes ago with your new game about how you're at that point, or you're going to be at that point soon, where you're going to start to be able to take away elements to try to get down to that core foundation of your title. And a major point that I do want to touch back on is what you said a few minutes ago, where the one of the big differences or defining qualities of that game company is the fact that you guys approach things from an experience angle first, as opposed to a mechanic or a game design structure. And that's very interesting, because that's something we don't hear from a lot of developers, especially a lot of developers who I've had on these podcasts in the past. Usually when we talk to them and I ask them, you know, where these games come from, they basically talk about a mechanic or some kind of game system that they want to grow and extrapolate a concept out of.
Yeah.
The only other developer who I've spoken to who went like the story or narrative angle was when I spoke to Jeff Vogue from Spireweb Software. And he basically makes a lot of RPGs, turn-based, you know, 2D style, the classic games from the PC. So taking this back to that game company, as you said regarding this experience, how really do these games get started? Like, do you just start with like a thought? Do you guys brainstorm ideas and then go from there?
Well, so a couple interesting things, I guess, I can tell you. One thing is we I wouldn't say we start with the music, but we've had a full-time in-house composer from the start of the project. So when the project starts, there's sort of like a little, like an inkling of a feeling or a sort of a general inspiration or a direction. But it's really a longer-term process of the team understanding like what that feeling is for ourselves. And we do a lot of mood boards isn't exactly it, but we do a lot of sort of sharing of media and films and anime and images and music and trying to kind of build up like what the what the feeling is, so we can communicate that, because it's very difficult to communicate feelings with words. And our team, the art director and our creative director, are both we're both born in China, so they have a very different like cultural and language background. Our lead artist is from Japan, so we have a very kind of like mixed cultural team. So a lot of the initial process is really about finding shared references that make sense, that inspire us and like, you know, trigger the feelings that we're going for. At the same time, like we do a lot of, even though we're not mechanics centric, we do a lot of prototyping of mechanics. It's really just that we're not wedded to a single mechanic at the beginning of the game, is really, and we're not looking to the mechanics to, well, I mean, the game is mechanics. So at the end of the day, like it is mechanics that are creating these feelings and contributing, but it's also sort of, I think we take a pretty holistic approach of saying it's also the environments. It's also the music. I mean, in Journey, if you take the music out of Journey, it's like a totally different experience. So in some ways we're almost more approaching it like a film maybe, where just the aesthetics of the experience are equally important, if not more important than the mechanics. Really, we just want to like make mechanics that are accessible to a wide range of people, which is a huge challenge in itself. So figuring out that is sort of like the big design challenge a lot of the time. And then for the whole team, the conceptual challenge is figuring out like what the feeling that we're exploring is really about for us, and how can we express that through narrative and through visual imagery and through music, and through the mechanics.
And you mentioned doing a lot of prototyping of your mechanics. And I was just wondering then, another thing that I've spoken to a lot of developers about, especially those from the strategy or 4X market, who those games are, as we all know, predominantly mechanics-based. It's really about system integrations and a whole lot of stuff we could spend a few hours talking about. And they talked about their process as essentially finding a core mechanic or a core foundation of the game. And then once that works, building that out and, you know, having everything sort of flow from that one thing.
Yeah, we talk about, it's funny, we talk about core mechanics a lot, actually, in this almost like paradoxical way, where we have to, I don't know, because we're all gamers also, and we love a lot of games that have very, you know, cool core mechanics. I think all of us, the designers, are really, we're drawn to making systems and drawn to making mechanics that are just interesting in their kind of an end in themselves, just mechanically interesting. And on one level, that's like important because some of those mechanics do wind up in the game. But on another level, like ultimately, it feels like those mechanics actually distract from the feelings we're trying to communicate. Like in the new game we're working on, similar to Journey, we're trying to create an experience of sort of being in the world with another person. And one of the challenges we've been hitting up against lately is any mechanic we add to that almost seems to distract from the other person that you're with. You become sort of more engaged with the mechanic or in the sort of work of the world, as opposed to the experience of being there. It's sort of like almost a doing versus being problem. So coming up with mechanics that they kind of like encourage being as opposed to the doing is really hard and interesting, but I feel like that's often what we're thinking about. But we're always saying, oh no, it's too gamey. Like we come up with a really cool mechanic and we're like, oh, that, you know, that would totally work. Like this could be a game. We're often saying that, but we're like, but it's not this game. So yeah, it's a very tempting space to be in of like wanting to just make a fun, interesting, intellectually stimulating system. But ultimately that's really not what our games are about.
That's a very interesting point, Michael, about trying to make a game that, for all intents and purposes, can be defined as a game with mechanics, but without distracting from your core experience or what you want to elicit from the player. And That's one of those things that it's definitely a little bit out of my wheelhouse. I've spoken on these casts. I am definitely a mechanics man myself. I love a lot of the mechanic heavy games, tactical strategy, you know, the whole deal there.
Yeah, I do too.
And it's definitely interesting to hear these types of discussions, because for me, when I hear, you know, a very interesting mechanic, I'm like, you know, let's go for it type deal, as opposed to a story. But as you're saying with that game company, it's really about getting that experience. It's what you said a Journey was about, example with your father playing it.
Uh-huh. I mean, it was interesting with Journey and with my dad playing, actually. Like, most of Journey, all you have to do is, like, hold forward on the control stick. There's almost... It's not challenging, but there's a ton of sort of moment-to-moment feedback, the way the cloth around the character moves, the way the sand parts, the wind. So even though you're not doing that much, it's like very low effort, but tons of feedback.
Yeah.
And there are places in Journey where you have to, it's a little bit more of a skill challenge. You have to do some platforming or energy management. And those are the places where my dad actually got stuck and I had to help him. But he got so much out of just pushing forward on the stick and seeing the character move through this very kind of rich space and seeing another person in the world with him and being able to shout at that person and have them shout back. Like, it's so basic. It's almost like reptilian brain mechanics as opposed to primate or human brain mechanics. That was enough. I mean, whether that's a game or not is like an interesting argument, I guess. But I think that's sort of that's for us the core experience, is like the accessibility and the richness of the interactivity without the the intellectual or physical skill based challenge that a lot of game mechanics come with.
And this is probably a good question to ask. Go back to what we just said a minute ago with trying to figure out these mechanics. And for your studio, as you say, you do a lot of prototyping, trying to figure out just the right mechanic to go with the experience you're trying to get. Mm-hmm. So my question is, how do you get to that point? Like, what happens when you're playing a mechanic and go, you know, this is perfect, let's put this into our next game?
Usually what happens, I mean, we do a lot of internal playtesting, and we're just playing the game a lot. So usually, you know, someone will make something or a variation on something that was already there. I wish I could, like, say specific things. But, I've been working on sort of the locomotion, like how the character moves. And well, that's something I've worked on in the past. And, you know, it's a pretty complex system, but on the surface, it should feel very intuitive and simple, and, like, you know, the player shouldn't be aware that a lot's going on under the hood. So, you know, oftentimes we'll change something where, you know, something under the hood will change in some relatively subtle way, but everyone will say, like, oh no, like this feels way better. Like, what changed? Like, they don't even know what changed. They can't put their finger on it exactly, but something feels more like what we're all imagining the game should feel like. And then we try to, you know, kind of lock that down. But the real challenge is other systems are always changing. So it's like this, I don't know, like house of Jell-O kind of thing, where we have multiple complex interrelated systems. We have a flat hierarchy, so multiple people are working on overlapping systems. And we definitely have a lot of kind of like code rot, where like a system will feel good and then other things will change and then it will be broken. And then, months will go by and, something that felt right, now we've kind of like lost that magic feeling, and that's really hard. So that's something I'm definitely thinking about more for the future, is how do we do a better job preserving the stuff that's working. And it's a challenge. It's a very organic, chaotic process at times, but I think we're all to some degree game designers. Everyone on the team is sort of thinking of themselves as a game designer. Our composer teaches game design at USC. So, like, everyone's kind of looking at the game from this sort of critical design perspective and saying, like, what's working, what's not. And we talk a lot about how the game feels and what works in a playtest and what doesn't. We do playtests with different combinations of people just to see how that changes things. We have outside playtesters come in through a focus group service, and we observe them playing. So we just try to get a lot of people playing the game and see what happens.
Yeah. I'm glad that you brought back up the flat architecture at that game company, Michael, because that sort of bleeds into this question regarding the mechanics. As you said, when you have everyone contributing to the project in these all these different ways, it can sometimes be a little troubling or a little challenging to narrow things down, you know, pick something that this is going to be in the game. You know, this is set in stone. It won't be changed.
Yeah.
And as we said a few minutes ago, when I asked you about the flat architecture, do you think having this type of studio functionality helps or hinders the design process when it actually comes to building the game?
I don't think our games could come out of a hierarchical process. Mm-hmm. I don't know. Our lead engineer recently said to me that he kind of admitted that we were talking about our process. And he was like, look, like I know we're like 99% inefficient, but we've had like three, you know, basically critical hits. And so the only assumption we can make is like somewhere in that inefficiency is the magic. And we maybe don't know enough about our own process yet in a way to isolate that. So the best we can do is kind of accept the process is what it is and just keep showing up every day and kind of allow the creative process to take place and I guess take faith in the fact that it's worked before on these, you know, other previous games. Mm-hmm. So I don't know. It's hard. I sometimes crave a little bit more structure. But I think at the end of the day, it's really like, it's not necessarily the flatness, but I think more the fact that like everyone in the company, like I said, kind of thinks of themselves as a designer to some degree, and is thinking critically about the game. That's really important. And it's like, I don't know. I think that's what's most important for us.
Okay. Now, another part of that game company that I definitely want to touch on with you, Michael, is the art and the music. As you said at the start of the cast, that a lot of your games really start with the music. And we said a few minutes ago regarding how a lot of the little touches in your games really add up to creating that emotional experience. Mm-hmm. You mentioned, you know, like the flourish of the cape, the mm-hmm. music, the art, etc. With that game company, the first, I guess, general question then for you is, how do you guys really approach things from an art aesthetic point of view? Do you guys have like a specific art style that you like for your games?
Well, it's interesting. Like we have a lead artist and we have an art director. Art director Jackie was the animator on Journey. He did the character design and the animations on Journey. And then we also, that's sort of one half of the puzzle. And then we also have a lead engineer named John, who he did on Journey, like all the sand, kind of like the way the sand moves, the moment to moment kind of feedback of the world. And if you ask someone like, what's the defining sort of visual motif of Journey? For me, it's more the sand, the way the sand moves. The architecture plays an important role too. And the character design is important, but we really focus on, we call it grain play, like graphics as gameplay, mm-hmm. where just the kind of like way the pixels move on the screen and the way they react to you is kind of the visual centerpiece of the game. And that, in terms of art direction there, like that's really coming out of, we have our own engine, and the art direction really comes out of the engine and what the engine's capable of doing. And what kind of grain play systems are working in the game. So that's sort of one, that's one half of the art. And the other half is sort of the world building, where we're trying to figure out the story of the world and the architecture, the character design. So those two things happen in parallel, really, between engineering and art. But it's not like... you know, the artists are doing concept pieces and paint overs that are images from the engine and based on what the engine is capable of. And then the engineers are getting inspired by the concept art that the artists are coming up with and the flourishes they're adding. And the, you know, maybe they're taking a shape of a piece of terrain that's in the game now that the engine is good at doing. And then they're making a modification and a paint over. And then the engineers say, oh, well, we could do that this way if we, you know, change how this, whatever, this material works. So it's this real back and forth between the art and the engineering that, I don't know, I think that's where our kind of unique visual style comes from, is that kind of, I don't know, back and forth between those two.
Okay. And I guess sort of tying that question in with the actual game development, do you guys usually establish an art style or art aesthetic before the mechanics, or does that come like later in the refinement process?
It's, they're happening in parallel. Okay. So we have this really amazing lead artist, and he has like sketchbooks upon sketchbooks of like really interesting drawings and ideas, and almost as probably as many mechanics as we've come up with, he has even more drawings and ideas. And it's really like this ongoing process of trying to wed interesting visual motifs and ideas with mechanics. And it's like I don't know what a good analogy is, but like all the parts of the game are kind of getting stitched together into each other at the same rate. So no one part of the game, even the music, which's been, you know, under development for, 3 years now, is still changing based on a new mechanic idea or a new piece of art or a change in the character design, saying, oh no, the character is more, you know, is more powerful than we thought. Like the music should be more, you know, reflect that more. The character needs to be more fragile and weak, so the music needs to reflect that. So it's this really, I don't know, everyone's leaning on everyone else kind of experience.
All right. And talking about the game design of that game coming, I definitely want to touch a little bit more on Journey. Mm-hmm. And that will sort of take us to the end of this section of the podcast. Mm-hmm. Earlier in the cast, you talked about one of Journey's more defining aspects, which is the fact that the game has no in-game communication. Everything is done through the characters' motions and gestures. There's no voice chat. Mm-hmm. And that led to a lot of very interesting discussions, especially when you look at things from a mechanic or design point of view. When you look at most video games that have to do with play and multiplayer, mm-hmm. voice chat is pretty much considered a requirement. A multiplayer right. game without voice chat is not a multiplayer game for a lot of people.
Mm-hmm.
And with you guys and Journey, that pretty much went the complete opposite direction of that. And I know that was a very polarizing topic for a lot of core gamers looking at the game compared to the casual audience.
Uh-huh.
Now, you said that you came on after Journey was already released and developed, but I don't know if you know the answer to this, but was that decision to make the game completely silent, how did that really like come about? Was there any like real discussion or debate at the studio for that?
Well, I know like generally with Journey, the approach was to remove, it was sort of the design by subtraction again. It was like to remove anything that didn't add to a positive experience of being in the world with someone else and basically meeting a stranger and feeling connected to them in some way. Mm-hmm. So I don't know for a fact whether there was ever voice chat in Journey or not. But I imagine that if there was, that it didn't, you know, basically voice chat would, or even text chat, tends to take you sort of out of the world of the game and put you back into your you know,
the real world.
Real world. Mm-hmm. So I know for me, like I play first person shooters and I generally leave the voice chat off because I would rather just like not, it breaks the magic for me to hear other people. And I'm not such a, I'm not so into the strategy and team play that it's required. Mm-hmm. So I think for Journey, it was like, well, what are we trying to do? If we're trying to make a game where people, you know, collaborate on complex strategical problems, then yeah, you probably do need voice chat. But if you really just, if the game is walking, and a little bit of flying and jumping, then you don't have to be able to speak to do that. And in the game, you can kind of chirp. There's like a song kind of note that you can communicate with, almost like Morse code. Mm-hmm. And that, I think if we didn't have that, it would have been, something would have been lost. But the fact that you're able to, you know, you can tap quickly if you're excited, or you can do or if you're scared, you can do one really long, charged up, loud shout if you're, you know, want to celebrate. And there's a lot of nuance that comes just in that one-dimensional communication between people. And it functions also as a way to like activate stuff in the world. So it's a sort of multi-purpose. That's an example of a mechanic that doesn't hinder the experience. It works in terms of the player-to-player communication. It works in terms of activating stuff and connecting with the world. It's almost like an invisible, you don't even think of it as a mechanic necessarily, but it totally is. Mm-hmm. You're just not aware of it in that way when you're playing the game. It just feels very natural.
Yeah. And that point about trying to separate real life from the game is mm-hmm. a really good point. It's something we definitely see with games that are just trying to elicit that specific emotion. Another example that came a few years later after Journey, I think, would be like Dark Souls and the whole Demon Souls series that also went for no in-game voice chat, just specifically through in-game messaging. Mm-hmm. And as you said, Michael, it may not be the most optimal from a play perspective, but it really helps with the lore and defining this world.
Yeah, I love the Dark Souls. We talk about Dark Souls a lot at work. It's really ironic because we're such like a sort of touchy feely positive company, but we're always talking about Dark Souls.
And Dark Souls is a very loving game. You know, everyone is so nice and friendly with each other in that game.
Yeah.
Oh yeah.
I love Dark Souls. The messaging in that, because it's this sort of like constrained system where like people can still express themselves and be make jokes, be humorous, be helpful. Like there's still it's limited, but there's still an opportunity to express relationships and identity, your real world identity. But because it's filtered through the game, it kind of like becomes part of that reality instead of, you know, taking you out and thinking like, oh yeah, that, you know, Josh, he's a funny guy. He left that message there. I'm just thinking about, oh, you know, I'm not thinking about you. I'm thinking about your character.
Mm-hmm. All right. I have a few more general game design related questions for you, Michael, and then we'll move on to our big topic then to wrap up the cast.
Okay.
First one is, as we said over the course of this cast, a major part of that game company's style and MO is the experience of the game, trying to get some kind of emotion or experience from the player, and as you said, cutting out things that would either distract or get in the way of that. So with that said, I'm just wondering, what are your thoughts on pretty much how more outside elements are finding their ways into games? Some examples would be achievements. We're seeing, you know, that's become a huge part of design and moving people to play. There's the casual and monetization side of things where, you know, bug your friends, you know, get 5 diamonds if you get your friend to sign on, stuff like that. When you hear mechanics and systems like that, how do you respond to that?
Well, I totally understand the motivation of those mechanics. And I've never been like super into completing challenges and like 100% in games. I have friends who do that, and I understand the motivation there. I don't know. It really comes down to like what do you want your players to be looking for in your game? Like, if achievements are great, if the feeling that you're trying to communicate is a feeling of empowerment and achievement. You know, that's what a lot of games are really about, is sort of an empowerment experience or trip to some degree. And achievements, leveling up, progression mechanics like that all feed into a very sort of basic, I don't know, human need to feel competent and to feel successful. And that's very powerful stuff. And casual games and mobile games are like super fascinating. I love reading about all the crazy monetization strategies, and I find them pretty scary. As kind of like general research for a while, I was trying to spend, I think, like $5 or $10 a month on mobile games just to like understand the psychology. Mm-hmm. And I think what wound up happening was I often came away feeling like either shame in spending money, or it wasn't positive feelings, or I'd been tricked, or it was worthless. Like, one of the most interesting things I think happens with those types of games is there's a kind of psychological trick of, first you spend some time playing, and then once you've spent time, you're like, oh, well, you know, this I've spent so much time playing this game, it must be good. It must be valuable. Otherwise, I wouldn't have spent all that time, so I might as well spend a little money. And then once you spend a little money, then you're like, well, I've spent time and money. Like, only a really stupid person would spend time and money on something that wasn't valuable. So this must be valuable. They're like self-reinforcing in a way. Mm-hmm. And you get into this sort of trap of, I don't know, it's almost like a cognitive dissonance with yourself, where leaving the system means admitting that you were wrong in some way. And that was definitely a feeling that I stumbled upon a few times and didn't like. So I don't know, if like, if your goal is to keep the money rolling in, then those are great strategies. If your goal is to give people a sense of achievement, then achievements and, you know, character progression is a really powerful way to do that. It all just depends on what your goal is as a designer, I think, and as a studio or a company, I guess, long term.
Yeah. And I'm the same way. I try to play a lot of the free-to-play games, the ones I've made to the PC, and they really just don't hold my attention for a long time, because it really is about trying to get as much money out of the player, and it's just about, you know, extending the basic experience without any real growth.
Yeah.
And I find from my personal play style, I prefer to just spend, you know, $5-$10, own the game, and then, you know, go into it at my own pace without getting bugged to spend, you know, 10 cents here or having to bug my friends for stuff.
Yeah.
And that has really become a major point for a lot of core and hardcore gamers who are just completely and utterly opposed to anything free to play.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, it's unfortunate because I think there is, I don't know, I still see a lot of potential in free to play. And I don't know, my hope is the pendulum will somehow swing back the other way and there'll be a, I don't know, like a free-to-play renaissance of some kind where people don't feel like as abused. I think a lot of it just comes down to the fact that like free-to-play games often expose like the kind of the worst parts of the game's mechanics. Mm-hmm. Things that if you've just paid for the game up front, like you wouldn't, I don't know, you just wouldn't be aware of that. But now there's like, you know, you're waiting extra time for your you know, units to build. Mm-hmm. And you feel like, well, why am I waiting? I could pay $1 and skip this wait. Like, why is the game making me wait? Like, what does that add to the experience other than to create an opportunity for me to pay? So I don't know. I think mm-hmm. it's tricky. It's really hard design. I mean, I have a lot of respect for the people who make free-to-play games, though it's successful ones at least, because it's just such a, I think it's such a tricky psychological world to be in, but it's just it's a dance with the devil.
I think that's a good description there.
Yeah.
All right. My last question then for this section for you, Michael, mm-hmm. I think I know the answer to this one already, but I just want to get your thoughts on what do you think about the push or the move of virtual reality over the last few years. We're seeing more and more news out of the Rift. I know, I think there's been something announced for Sony regarding virtual reality lately.
Yeah.
And I'm just wondering, from a studio perspective or just from your own opinion, what do you think about how VR is slowly coming back into our lives?
I'm generally excited by it as a consumer. Like I demoed the Oculus, the new one, Crescent Bay, the one that has the head tracking. And it was really cool. I mean, I think for me as a game developer, it's almost like, I don't know if this analogy makes sense, but I used to do theater in high school. And then for a while, when I would go to see a play or whenever I was in a theater, I was just really aware of all the technical stuff that was going on in the background. Mm-hmm. And I feel like with VR, I'm just very much in that mindset of trying to break it down and figure out where the flaws are almost. I think the VR experiences that I've had that I was most impressed by were the ones that were not asking me to feel a certain way. If that makes sense. Like there was in the demo I did, there was a really interesting piece where it was just kind of like a floating tabletop, and on the table was this really intricate like little village with like a train going through, and it was very stylized and beautiful, and there were people walking on the street, and that really ignited my imagination in terms of being able to peek down and look in windows and kind of witness this village happening. That felt great, but then there was also part of the demo where like a Tyrannosaurus Rex runs at you and you're supposed to feel scared, and I didn't feel scared because I don't know, maybe because I'm a game developer or I don't know, it wasn't that scary to me. So I felt very awkward being in this space where I was supposed to feel one thing and I'm really in the space, but I'm not feeling it. Almost felt like I was a bad actor or like I wasn't playing my part. So I don't know. That's all very interesting stuff. I think I thought the Minecraft demo at E3 was pretty awesome during the Microsoft press conference, just being able to sort of beam your Minecraft game onto a table and then be able to look at it in that kind of like Legos world scale was really cool. I think the biggest challenge is still going to be like, what is the interaction in that, in these worlds going to be? Like, it makes great sense for sort of being in a space, but actually taking action in that space and like moving around in it is still a hard problem. I don't know. I think there's a lot of money going into it, so it's gonna turn into something. I don't know what yet.
Yeah.
I'm very curious about Facebook's relationship with Oculus and what they're secretly planning for us all.
Yeah.
I'm really curious if they're going to do like a 3D home movie capture system where you can just like put a device on the table and it will capture a whole room in 3D somehow, and you'll be able to go back and sit in that experience again and relive it. I think that would be very Philip K. Dick and very awesome. Yeah. So yeah, I don't know. It's exciting, exciting time. My worry, I guess, with VR is it'll be kind of like the motion stuff was whenever,
like the Kinect and the Move.
Yeah, and it came out and Kinect came out and it was like, oh, it's the future of gaming is movement. And, you know, there aren't that many really great Kinect games. I don't think there are any games that anyone said to me, like, this is an amazing experience. You need to play this Kinect game. It was more like, you know, turn on head tracking for first-person shooter or your driving game. And, you know, my wife plays the Zumba game with the Kinect and I don't even know if it's really tracking anything. It's just saying great job over and over again. So so there was a little bit of like not false hope, but I had disappointment there. But I think it was also a lot of hype when in reality, like the best way to play video games is still kind of maybe not to use the Kinect. Mm-hmm. Otherwise, there'd probably be better or more games that take advantage of it.
Yeah. And it's definitely something we're going to have to see more of in the next few years. I know I've spoken to a few guests previously who are very excited about the future, but we're talking like 5-10 years from now.
Mm-hmm.
And I think until we actually see the commercial version of the Rift being sold, that will sort of be the first real gauging moment for whether or not VR will pretty much become a major part of our lives.
Yeah, yeah.
All right, yeah, definitely. We've had a really great chat so far, Michael. And I know we could, this is another one of those times where we could just sit here and talk for the next few hours. But let's move on and talk about probably our big topic. And I know this is one that is going to be very interesting considering, as we've talked about, that game company's pedigree and MO for design.
Mm-hmm.
And that topic is art versus the business, or product versus art when it comes to game development. At the time of this recording, for those of you listening, one of the more shocking news out of the indie space was the exiting of Tale of Tales, the more infamous game developing studio who focused exclusively on art-style games.
Mm-hmm.
They decided to finally get out of the industry. They said they're tired of it. Their last game didn't make enough money, and they're just, you know, packing things up and getting out. And that has brought up a lot of debates regarding how video games are viewed, whether as an art, a product, or both. Mm-hmm. I made a big post about it around the time of Tale of Tales, which I'll be sure to put a note in the podcast about that. And I think the first question, probably the hardest one to ask to get this rolling with you, Michael, is one that I know that has been asked so many times in the past, and that is, are video games art? You know, that very simple question. I know you've probably heard that question a few times.
Yes, they are. Yes. They're also products, but they're definitely art.
Yep, and that's where I am at exactly on that too. And this is really one of the more interesting parts, especially when you talk to a lot of enthusiasts or people trying to get into the game industry, they view things probably 100% from the art side of things.
Mm-hmm.
And one of the lessons that have really been hammered into me from talking to developers, especially those who also manage their own studio, is the fact that you do need to balance the art with the product. It's not just about making something that is unique, never before seen, it's going to, you know, touch people emotionally. We also have to think about how this is going to do in the market. Will this be able to support your studio, your family, etc.?
Yeah.
Now, for you, Michael, with that game company, obviously, we've talked over the last hour about your studio's focus on developing the experience. You've said a few times that your design style is very slow. We said that there's been a three-year gap between each of your games. Mm-hmm. And I've spoken to developers who they couldn't even go, you know, 5-6 months without putting a game, let alone 3 years. They just, yeah. You know, they have to be able to keep putting something out in order to keep those bills going. Uh-huh. So for you and the rest of the studio, how do you approach that type of mindset of balancing making experience versus making something that's profitable?
It's a hard part of the process. I mean, TGC is in a pretty unique place of having had the support of Sony in the past, kind of established ourselves as a kind of a viable studio in terms of the games we make being products that people will pay for them. We've kind of proved that. I guess we proved it enough that someone was willing to, you know, invest in us. And now we're really at a point where, like, I don't know, it really feels like we are putting ourselves to the test. Like, nothing feels really, you know, for sure we have a best-selling game here. That's our hope, and we're sort of aspiring to, like with our past games, make something that is both artistically inspired, but really accessible. I think that's probably where I think about it as a product the most, is that, like, this is something that, like, you know, anyone is supposed to be able to pick up and play and have an experience. And that in itself makes it much more viable as a product than a lot of games. I think even games that kind of seem like they're more casual or more accessible, like, I don't know, I tried to get my wife to play Gone Home, because thematically and narratively, I thought she'd really like it. And it's of the time that she was growing up, and there was a lot of references that I knew she would appreciate. But just, like, the act of walking around, you know, AWSD and with a mouse was, like, more than she could handle. So in terms of, I guess, product, I think about accessibility. In terms of, we're definitely more focused on art and less concerned about the money side of things. I guess our belief is if we make a really great game, then the money will come. But I know that's, like, a luxury to be able to believe that. And most people, most developers are really, you know, working game to game. I don't know. I mean, I think there's a place for sort of, like, pure art games. And there's definitely a place for, like, the blockbuster, very sort of product-y games. I see it very much like the film industry, where there are art films that are totally worth making and a smaller audience really appreciates them. And there are big blockbuster movies for large audiences. I think the key is, like, how do we, as an industry, figure out a way to do both and not have, you know, not have people, you know, overlook indie games in favor of the AAA stuff or kind of get turned off from the AAA stuff because they don't think there's any art there, where there is totally, I mean, I can't think of any, like, AAA studio that does not, on some level, think of what they're doing as art. Like, you wouldn't be in this industry, I don't think, if you didn't feel like you were, I don't know, making something artistic. It's not, I don't know, it's just not in the DNA of game developers, I don't think. So, I don't know. I'm mostly avoiding your question right now. It's a really hard question. I don't have a good answer for how to do it. But
go ahead.
I was going to say, I think the more dialogue there can be between sort of indie and larger studios, and I don't know, I think that's good. I think Sony is doing a good thing by, you know, publishing big games and having and Microsoft too. I mean, the sort of indie subculture of those consoles is a really great thing, that they're supporting games and encouraging innovation. And obviously a lot of those indie games are getting a lot of press now, and we'll probably make good money. So,
yeah. And as you're just saying, the fact that this is a hard question to answer is another major point. As I said, every developer really has their own unique path through this game industry. And that's both great and terrible at the same time. It's great that anyone can really take a path to be able to make a game, but at the same time, it's very hard to tell someone, you know, how do you become a game developer? Mm-hmm. What is a good game? What is a bad game? And mm-hmm. even with this topic, you know, how do you make something that's a product, but you're still trying to make something that's artistic? Mm-hmm. Now, what you said regarding accessibility, I think that's another really strong point. Because some of the best-selling games are the ones that are the most accessible. There's a reason why companies like Nintendo and Valve and even Blizzard are still some of the kings of the hills. They make games that they, you know, iterate the hell out of them to try to make something that can appeal to a larger group. Mm-hmm. If you're trying to make something like, for example, like the roguelike genre, which has seen some mainstream popularity with, of course, Dark Souls and Demon Souls, it's still very much a niche experience due to the explicit design to not be very accessible. I mean, yeah. It's not exactly a game that you're going to hand to your, you know, 60-year-old mother and say, here, enjoy this as your first game.
I can barely play it, yeah.
Yeah. Now, talking about accessibility, that actually brings me a little bit into talking more about Tale of Tales. For you, Michael, have you played or experienced any of the Tale of Tales games?
I'm really embarrassed to say I haven't.
Sadly, that's perfectly fine. I know a lot of people who haven't either. They're a studio. They have really, if we were to have that spectrum of, you know, one in business, one in art, they are the way on the art side.
Oh, no, yeah. I'm very familiar with the company. I mean, it's sort of telling in a way, like, I know of their games and I've, you know, looked at pieces of them, but I've never actually played through any of them.
Yeah. And that, I think, is a really good point. I've played... I think I played 3 or 4 of them. They're very, very small experiences. Even their biggest game, Sunset, which is the one that just came out at the time of this recording, was only a few hours long. And one of the things about their games is that, to be honest, they're not really that accessible. They're all about telling like a very specific, very esoteric story, but mm-hmm. they feature very cumbersome controls. They don't really lend themselves to a mass market approach. Mm-hmm. And it's kind of interesting when we're talking about art versus product that with that game company, as we've said, even though your games are about an experience, they're about something very unique, they're also meant to be played by a lot of people. And I think that's a really good point or a very good bridge between an art versus a product. If your games were completely art, you know, you wouldn't care about whether or not someone who's never played a game could play them. You wouldn't care about how the game feels in the hands of someone who's never played it. But when you do think about that, that is, even though that is about the experience, it's also about delivering a quality product.
Yeah, I mean, it's like kind of a, I mean, it's really a question of like, who is the art for? Mm-hmm. And you know, making a game that's you know, complex and inaccessible and explores some esoteric ideas may be totally worth doing, but it seems crazy to expect it to also be financially mm-hmm. viable. Like it needs to be done through grants or as a, I don't know, like the same way that you know, I guess in a way in the fine art world you can have, you know, conceptual art that is not accessible, but there is a culture that does appreciate it and pays money for it and supports that ecosystem. And right now, I guess we don't have that equivalent in the game world, which in a way it would be cool if we did. I mean, to some degree, I feel like, I don't know, Kickstarter's done a lot in that way where like you can have a really weird kind of esoteric idea for a game and like find the handful of people that are really into that idea and get them to pay for it. And that seems good. But yeah, I don't know. It's a really, I did a lot of like art in college, a lot of like kind of shock art and stuff that like people weren't supposed to like. and there's something powerful about kind of not pandering to your audience and not, you know, just expressing something in a raw way. And maybe there are people who would say like that's what art is, and if you're pandering or trying to make a, you know, make it accessible, then that's not art anymore. I don't know, but mm-hmm. I don't think there's any, in my mind, there's no rule that says art has to be inaccessible for it to be, you know, mm-hmm. Worthwhile.
Yeah, And that goes back to what we said at the beginning of the section, that video games are art, but at the same time, they're also a product. And being able to create something that is of both worlds is something meant for, you know, some of the highest quality games can really achieve that balance. Mm-hmm. Again, great examples, Nintendo, Valve, Blizzard, pretty much any like the major titles have that bit of art in them, but they also have that product. They're meant to sell something. Mm-hmm. And at the same time, of course, reward the team who spent, you know, months or even years working on that one title.
Yeah, that's what's like most crazy to me is that like video games, especially like indie iOS, you know, mobile games, like the expectation now, maybe, and it's to some degree because of free to play, is like that these things, just these experiences shouldn't cost anything. It should be free. And that's like a really, that expectation is, I think, really poisonous. Mm-hmm. And devalues games in general. So I do worry about that, especially from sort of an artistic, like, you know, we culturally we have a relationship with fine art where we like know, okay, fine art's in a museum, it's valuable. Mm-hmm. Maybe I pay to go to the museum, but I know the museum gets a lot of donate. Like, there's a sense that this, that fine art is important and valuable. And I feel like in the past 5 years or so, there's like a growing sense that games are kind of a dime a dozen. And that, that's, I don't know, sad to me. I think it hurts the industry. Cause making games is like the hardest thing. I think in the entertainment world, it's not the hardest thing you can do, in general, but in the world of like entertainment, it's just such a complex, so many different systems, and it's really hard, complex work that I don't think even a simple mobile game is a lot of work, and I don't feel like people understand that very well.
Yeah, and I spoke about that on an earlier podcast when we talked about the EFF versus the ESA on game preservation, and how a lot of people, especially a lot of consumers, don't view video games as an art. They see it strictly as a product, something that when the next console comes out or the next game, you can just throw out or sell your old game. Mm-hmm. And it's becoming harder and harder to preserve games. There's that general stigma that a lot of people just don't care about backwards compatibility or game preservation. Mm-hmm. And as you said, Michael, that over the last like 5-10 years, we've really seen a lot of growth in game development and a lot of games that are definitely pushing more on the art side of things. There's, of course, your guys at that game company, a lot of indie games that go for unique experiences. But for the mass general market, either they don't care or they're not educated enough to understand that the amount of work that goes into these games really puts them on that side of art. But it's something that I think is going to reach ahead at some point where we really need to sit down the side. Are we going to look at video games or preserve video games in the same ways or similar to ways that we preserve paintings or books or et cetera?
Yeah, I think the I've been tickled lately by all the I mean, it's kind of a cop out in terms of the industry, but there's a lot of like remakes or remasters happening, like you know, Uncharted is getting remastered. Mm-hmm. Final Fantasy VII is getting a remaster or like a total, you know, makeover.
Yeah.
Our games are coming out on the PS4. And in that way, like there's a sense that like these older games are worth preserving and worth re-experiencing, and they hold a place in our, in the kind of our hearts and minds that's valuable. Mm-hmm. And there's like a real magic involved in like seeing them reborn or fixed up for the, you know, the modern consoles. And I don't know if there's an equivalent from the fine art world of that, but it makes me excited about the fact that there's a generation now of people who have kids themselves, really, and have grown up with games. And I think like once, I don't know, in another 30 or 60 years, once there's like multiple generations who have experienced video games, I think we're going to have a very different relationship with like talking about the games our grandparents played. Like, I don't know. It's interesting to me to think of like having grandkids and telling them about like when I played the original Final Fantasy VII, you know, and now they're playing like some remake of it that's like still connected in some way, that there's like a, I don't know, a longevity in the medium that kind of gives me hope.
And it's interesting to talk about remaking and making these remaster editions of games, because one of the more fascinating topics we've talked about on these podcasts and in posts on Game Wisdom is how much game design has really changed from the 80s to today. We've seen, you know, complete revamps of standardization, design mechanics, and even what's successful and what's not. There was a time where games like King's Quest and all the super brutal adventure games were considered, you know, accessible and normal for the market.
Yeah, we're like missed.
Oh my God, Miss. And now today, we have games like Telltale, who have approached things more for a story and narrative, and the adventure game is sort of like the loose wrapper, but it's not, it's never going to hit that same point as those games. But then, and like the strange thing, those games are still around thanks to indies, and as you said a few minutes ago with Kickstarter, with providing the funding for these ideas that wouldn't make it in the mainstream. Like, there are a lot of great games or a lot more ambitious titles that you wouldn't see come from a AAA publisher or be funded that way, but they're getting that life on Kickstarter and through crowdfunding.
Yeah, totally. I mean, I do, it's funny talking about all this accessibility stuff. At the same time, like, I totally see all, like, a ton of value in really hard, inaccessible games and like the experience of learning them. Like, I brought in my Super Nintendo to work recently, so we just have the couple games that it's the same Super Nintendo I had when I was a kid. And I was playing Super Mario World, and like, which I used to play all the time with my sister, and I was like realizing like, this is like a pretty hard game. Like, in my memory it wasn't that hard, but it's pretty challenging platforming. And there's something kind of like magical about, as a kid, really struggling with a hard game and like just doing it over and over and over again, and slowly over, you know, slowly getting better at it. And I worry now with a lot of the kind of games that are especially ones that aimed at kids, that, you know, accessibility, there's so many choices and so many options that if your game is hard, like, the fear is that people are just going to put it down right away. And like, how do you keep people playing when it is hard and when it is inaccessible? And maybe the thing is, like, those games, like Super Mario World, the basic mechanics are understandable. Like, it is easy to learn on some level, but it has a lot of depth, and that's very powerful. Though I do remember having games as a kid that were just, like, hard as hell. Yes. Like, there's just no way. Like, I had NES games that were, like, I think there was a Jaws game I had. I don't think I ever made it out of the first level. I just played the first level over and over again.
Oh, man, like Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtles, like the original game, that was a nightmare. A few years ago, I went to this conference where I had like these impossible game challenges, and they were all just like playing the old NES games normally. And it's just as hilarious to think that these games growing up where we found normal, today they're considered these you know, impossible Titan challenges to try to achieve.
Yeah, we're gonna like in 20 or 30 years, we're gonna be like telling our kids or grandkids, like, when I was your age, like, I had to buy a cheat book. To, you know, I had that special controller where you could like switch it on so it'd do like fire mode for the buttons, and I had a freaking Game Genie. And
there we go. I was waiting for you to say that.
Oh, man.
Oh, yes. The Game Genie. That's another thing. In like 10 years, like, no one except for us old guys will know what that is.
Yeah, well, it's sad that we're the old guys.
Yeah.
But so it goes.
Yep. And with like this type of debate with talking about accessibility, Mario, Nintendo especially, I think, is a great example of just being able to design their games to approach things from these different skill levels and groups. Like, I was playing the new one on the Wii U, Super Mario, I think it was like New Super Mario 3D World or something like that. And it starts out very easy. Like, I was bored with it. And then by the end, that game just kicks your ass. Like, when Nintendo takes the gloves off with their games, oh my God, they can make things hard. Let's just say that.
That's funny.
Let's see. Anything else to talk about with art and business? I guess one other question I want to ask you. Now, when you talked about a few minutes ago that that game company is definitely in a special spot compared to most indie studios. As I've said, a lot of people I've spoken to, they really do live from game to game. So my question for you is, for any like students listening to this or enthusiasts thinking about getting into the industry, are there any like hard lessons you've learned about making a video game versus making art that you could relate to them?
Well, I know on the previous game I worked on my own, or it was with a small group of friends, we had this weird moment in that project where we went from like, we basically started off making an art game slash learning project where we just like, we're interested in making a game and working together. And we had a really cool artist we were working with. And we're just sort of making this thing because we thought it was worth making, as an art piece, really. And then at some point, like, we started getting a little bit of feedback and interest from people. And this like thought crept into our minds that like, we could have the next Angry Birds on our hands. Mm-hmm. Like, you know, this could be it. And we kind of switched our thinking from really focusing on the, I don't know, game design and the art to being more kind of product thinking. And in a way, like, I don't know, we kind of got stuck between worlds where we made a game that was still this like kind of art piece. But at the same time, we did a lot of marketing. We spent a lot of money and time like marketing and doing promotion. And we did a contest and we got in the paper in Philly and we got on the news and we're really like pushing this thing. And it wound up doing okay. We didn't, you know, we spent a long time on it. We didn't make that much money to, you know, cover our costs. So I think being like clear with yourself about what your goals are and like what you're trying to do with your game is really important. Like, are you trying to make a game that sells well and, you know, as a business, or are you making an art game, or are you making an art game that you, you know, want to do a Kickstarter for the people that, you know, really appreciate that kind of game? I think, I don't know, not getting kind of stuck in the middle is advice I would give, though it's hard not to. I mean, it was really tempting for us because we were like, oh, it was very corrupting kind of in a way to like think of all this money. I remember I wrote up contracts with all the three or four guys I worked with, and I was like, all right, if the game makes $100,000 to $200,000, we're going to split it this way. And if it makes $1,000,000, this is how we're going to split it. And it made like $7,000 or something. So it was a lot of, I don't know, we kind of got caught up in the in that kind of thinking, and that distracted us from the fact that the game, like, actually, it was weird because the game actually wasn't, we didn't make it accessible either. Like, we didn't go all in and say like, let's make a really accessible, sellable game. We basically were like, let's make an art game and pretend it's going to make a lot of money, and that was like a bad combination for us. So
that reminds me, that actually sounds a lot like what I heard a little about from Tale of Tales. So their games, they make games, as we said, they went exclusively on the art side without any cares for accessibility. And unfortunately, I can't read their minds. Like, unfortunately, I was going to plan on talking to them, and then all this news happened. And one of the things is, I don't know if they really looked at their games as a product. Like, they were trying to make money. And as you said, when you start thinking about your game as a product and trying to get in the minds of how are you going to make this to sell to people, it really does change how you approach things. And I think your advice of keeping things in the middle is very smart. If you make your game too much like a product, then it just becomes very derivative, very soulless. If you make it too much like an art piece, you may alienate people, or you may not be able to make something that people will enjoy.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's true. It's funny. I think you like inverted what I was trying to say, which was don't get caught in the middle. Like, be clear about what you're making. But it's the opposite is just as true in a way. I think that's why it's such a confusing space. Like, you don't want to be like a soulless product. Mm-hmm. You don't want to be an inaccessible art piece. But you also don't want to be confused. I think what I was trying to say is you don't want to be confused about what you're making. You don't want to be making an art piece and think that it's a product, and you're only making a soulless product and be convincing yourself it's an art piece. Like, I think I think it is a matter of like finding the balance between those and then being clear with yourself about, as a developer, about what you're trying to achieve for your players.
And that goes back to probably a good point to start to wrap the cast up with, is when I spoke with Ernest Adams, we talked about how the best games are those that pretty much all the elements are in harmony with each other. Everything harmonizes. Nothing feels like it's out of place. And that really is a good point for what we just said about balancing or knowing what your game is. If you're trying to make an art piece, you're not going to want to add, you know, achievements and, you know, mobile style monetization tactics.
Sure.
If you're trying to make a product, then trying to go all out insane with, you know, a art style that's going to take 3 years to develop is not going to really work for that title.
Right.
And the best games, again, going back to some of the titans, you know, Nintendo, Valve, Blizzard, they really get what they want to make out of this game, and then they grow from there. You really do need your game to really connect with everything. Again, goes back to what you said with that game company, with trying to get that core vision or that core experience down, and then growing it from there.
Yeah.
This has definitely been a great ask, Michael, and this is one of those topics, as we've just said, it's very confusing. There's people and examples on both sides of the spectrum, and again, this goes back to the fact that there really isn't a standard path to making a game. I mean, dear God, how many different ways must there be to, and studio organizations as well. I mean, I've spoken to people who are literally, you know, a 1 or 2 man studio. That game company you said is 15 people. There are studios with, you know, 50, and who knows, like, you know, like the super big AAA studios, they could have, you know, 200-300 people working on a single title.
Yeah.
And all those different ways will produce a game.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, I like to think that, like, a game is ultimately like an expression of the relationships between all the different people that are working on it, that, like, it's this collaborative process, and there's, like, so many different people and minds involved, and I don't know. I like thinking of TGC's games as in that way, that it's sort of like each of us is in the game a little bit in some way, coming through.
Awesome. All right, so I think with that, we're going to begin to wrap things up for this cast. Again, there's so many ways we can approach this topic. I would definitely love to have you back on, either for one of our developer roundtable casts, or just to follow up with more topics regarding game development in the industry.
That'd be great.
All right. So with that, my final question then for you tonight, Michael, is, do you have any final thoughts on any of the topics we've discussed, or anything you would like to say to the fans listening to end this cast on?
Oh, I don't know. I guess stay tuned for the next game from TGC. It's going to be awesome. I wish I could talk more about it, but we're putting our hearts and souls into it, and it's going to be really great when it comes out. So I look forward to maybe we can have another conversation once the new game's out, and you can give me some feedback on it.
Awesome. And that actually, just to remind me, just a few quick logistics-related questions. As we said, your next game, we can't unfortunately announce it here, but it is going to be multi-platform. It's not going to be exclusive to PS4, right?
Correct.
And I guess this is a question I think I know the answer to, but I got to ask. Are there any plans of a release date at this point, or is it still way too much in the ether?
It's too much in the ether. I mean, we're working as fast as we can. we all want the game to be out as badly as our fans want it. Like, we want it 10 times harder. So, yeah, we're working hard. And, yeah, I mean, I guess, yeah, just stay tuned. We're it's coming.
Cool. All right. So with that, we're going to end things here for this episode of the Perceptive Podcast. Again, Michael, it's been a pleasure talking to you, and hopefully we can get you back on real soon.
That sounds great. Thanks, Josh.
Not a problem. So for those of you listening to the cast now, thanks so much for tuning into this episode. As always, if you'd like to contribute to Game Wisdom, we have several options available. To submit a guest piece for the site or be a future podcast guest, whether you're a developer, enthusiast, or like to be on a specific theme cast, you can find all the information and links under Submissions Wanted on the front page. To contribute to our ongoing Patreon campaign to secure some much-needed monthly funding, you can find me on Patreon under Josh Beister or Game Wisdom, and there is the Patreon banner on the top of the front page. Any donations would be greatly appreciated. And finally, if you'd like to watch me play games live, talk about their design, or just the general gameplay of them, you can find me on Twitch under GW Beister. I'm usually streaming around 10 Eastern nightly, and most of the recordings will go up on the Game Wisdom YouTube channel. So, again, thanks a lot for tuning in to this episode of the Perceptive Podcast. Have a great rest of the week, and we will talk to you again next time. Take care, everybody.